Mr. Natter, Real Six. Now, we're talking about the sort of signaller's dugout.
Yes.
You're telling me that the 62 set you largely used, you didn't use...
Well, it wasn't used on the battalion net at all, so that was superficial, but we got one issued, so we played around with it, you know, and we got a little bit of music very quietly when we got a chance to get in the sleeping bags, like.
Now, what did you use on the battalion net, then?
On the battalion net, we used the 31 set. All the while the 31 set, all the while we were there.
And can you tell us a bit more about the operation of the 31 set, sort of in action, sort of, you know...
Well, the 31 set, I really don't know the range. It weren't a great range. I suppose perhaps a couple of 3 mile, I don't know. Nothing much more than that. It was a backpack set. I think it weighed 31 pounds, I think. So I think that's where the 31 come from. It was for the days of transistor, so it must have been a valve set. And you've got a battery similar to what you used to get in the old radios, about 10 inches long, you know, a big square battery, quite a heavy battery in the bottom of it. There was a limited number of channels, so you knew what channel you were on, you see, you know, the Norfolks perhaps were, I don't know, sake of argument, on channel one, something like that. And, you know, the other battalions, you sometimes could hear the other battalions, but not, you weren't, you know, you didn't speak to the other battalions through the 30. We were just into battalion communication, the 31 set, and you were controlled from signal headquarters at battalion headquarters. You know, we'd be outstations. The easiest course of communication would be the field telephone. The signal platoon signalers had run the cable out from signal platoon, HQ and battalion headquarters to the companies. So we've got a telephone line coming out, you see, so field telephone would be on that. And then we'd run one out to our three platoons, and any listening post we'd got, we may run a telephone cable to that, or they communicate with us with an 88 set. Now, 88 sets are on the belt, like ammunition pouches, but they work in conjunction with a 31 set. So that's good, you see. You can also then talk to your platoons on their 88 sets from your 31 set. You've got a pair of earphones, and you've got a free-hanging microphone on about a couple of yards of cable. So you have to hold that in your hand. It's got a pressure switch on it. When you want to speak, you depress your pressure switch, and then you speak, and you release your pressure switch, and you can hear, you know, through your earphones. If you keep your pressure switch pressed, nothing comes through. You've got to release your pressure switch. So you've got to know what you're doing to operate one effectively.
How heavy was it?
Well, I think it was 31 pounds, I think.
Well, the 88, I thought.
Oh, the 88. I don't really know. The 88. It'd perhaps be about 10 or 12 pounds or something like that, hanging on your waist. I think you've got a battery one side and a transmitter the other. And that were headphones and a microphone as well.
And
yeah,
and the same pressure system.
Yeah, same pressure switch system on that. Yes, it was. Yeah, and that were basically how the communication were within the company.
And would you have a sort of telephone exchange?
At that time, no, we didn't. No, at that time, we didn't. Later on, they'd done us a little kind of I think it was American job. Little when we were in a bit of a more static position, it was like a small exchange with about 8 different key things on, so that you could talk to the platoons through that. But that would come later, actually, in the following year.
We will come back.
Yes.
So what else was in this dugout? I mean, you've got all this equipment in. But
well, the only other thing there, which was the only other thing we had with us, was a small pack. And that what you got in your small pack was all you'd got.
So what had you got in
there? Well, I suppose, really, let's think, in your small pack. The essentials for the start, really, you'd be your magazines, in my case, for my Sten gun. I may have acquired at least 4 magazines. Two I would keep on the Sten gun if it, when and ever it wanted to. I taped 2 together, in other words, so the rounds were on opposite ends of the 2 taped together. So a quick release and a swing over, and I could put the magazine straight in the other side. See, that was to give you then approximately, well, they hold 30 rounds and you don't put more than 28 in. So you'd be getting on for a fair number of rounds there. You could get off pretty quick. And so I had those 2 taped together. And I think I had 2 spare in the pouch. And they most likely were the box of ammunition in there. There were definitely some 36 grenades in the weapon pit, I know. And in the small pack, You would have, I'm just trying to think. You didn't get a lot of clothes. I suppose I got a pair of socks. You'd have your washing kit. You'd have your washing kit, yeah. Really, you may have had a, I don't know. You may have had a spare shirt. You didn't. You only had one pair of boots, and you only had one pair of trousers, and you only had one. And that time, it was under jungle green jacket with you. You didn't have a lot of stuff, you see, because if you, it could have been a very fluid occasion where you've got to get out in a hurry. So you know what you couldn't carry, you didn't take. So there were nothing more than really essentials with you. You know, there was writing pad, perhaps. I don't know. Well, they wouldn't be about much else. They wouldn't be much else, Peter, than that, really. And then you see, you got your rations. If you did have a move, you stick your rations in your pack. What you got left for that day? So they weren't. We weren't encouraged. You got your sleeping bag and all. You see, you didn't want to leave that behind if you had to get out in a hurry. That's an important thing, you know, sleeping bag. So I don't suppose they.
Did you sleep in? Did you have a? I mean, was it just the bag on the floor of the dugout?
It was. Oh yes.
A makeshift.
No, it was on them days. It was the bag on the floor of the dugout. The first time we'd ever had sleeping bags, and they were lovely. They comprises an inner and an outer, which were basically like two sleeping bags. One went inside the other one, and in that they tucked into like a waterproof sleeve. It was like waterproof on the bottom, and I think. Fabric on the top, and they all rolled up into a sausage, I suppose, about 2'6" to 3 foot wide, and about a foot in diameter. So quite a bulky thing, really. It weren't like the modern sleeping bags. And so you'd roll that on the floor, and you sleep in that. But coming on now from around about the beginning of November, now this was the era when the Chinese had the idea of taking these two big features, 355 and 317. Before the winter set in. If they could have took them, the old Commonwealth Division line would have to move back south of the Imjin, because those two dominating heights would have made it impracticable to soldier north of the Imjin at that time, you see. So this were coming up to then. Now the Chinese then decided to have a big push. I think, according to the records I've read of KOSB, there are about 10,000 Chinese, a Chinese division, I think it was, anyway, that attacked the KOSB on 217, 317 and the range of hills associated with them. This was on the nights of 4th, 5th and 6th of November 1951. Now we were on the, as I say, we weren't in the battles like KOSB were. We were on the side of 355 with the KSLI were. But the old brigade front got shelled. We knew something was going to happen because the Chinese started to intensify their barrages. I think that night, We could tell it were getting a bit serious, because the shell fire on falling on this KOSB position were getting dense and very heavy. And also over the 31 set, even though I weren't in contact with the KOSB, I was getting garbled messages from KOSB platoons and listening posts and what have you. I think that night we had 100% stand to. And it really was a battle. I mean, Speakman won the VC in that battle, so you know it was no skirmish, it was a battle.
What was it like under shell fire for the first time?
Well, it was very frightening, really. In that night period, one of those three nights, we were in the signal dugout, and a shell landed, well, I'll say on the roof, because I don't know quite, it must have been somewhere near the roof or on the outside of the roof, because the roof lifted up, dropped down, and you couldn't see across the dugout. It was night, but we got a torch, you know, and you couldn't see across the dugout. It was just the dust all fell through the roof. It was a bit frightening, and it was stand too, because we didn't know quite. Well, you see, we were on the hills, and the Chinese used to come up the valleys, so nobody really knew. We were all wired in nicely. When I was talking about position, I ought to have told you about that. We were at all the hilltops. Soon as you got there, if you could, you got your hole dug. And then you wired yourself in line with double apron. A double apron is using American pickets. And then you put your barbed wire on and you brought them down from the top. You perhaps put some strands of barbed wire from picket to picket horizontally. And then from each picket, you would bring a wire down to the ground and back up to the next picket. So it were like an apron. And in between those two, you would go with more wire. Then you'll put some scrim wire on the top, so everybody wanted to get that done, because that'll hold anybody up. The Chinese are great in numbers, and if you could hold them up on your wire, the old brain guns could take them, you know, take them down then, and had to slow them down. So we got wired in like that.
And what was a stand two like?
Stand two. Well, stand two is everybody awakening in the weapon pit. Everybody, 100% stand. Everybody, 100% stand two is that means everybody. And if the stand two happens to go on all night, as I believe it did on that worst night of that battle, you're up all night. You know, that's it. You're standing two, and you're looking out for movement. I mean, the platoons had more, how can we say, dangerous tasks than we, because they were slightly forward of us, being in battalion headquarters, but they surrounded us basically. And so you don't really know, because you can hear this going off. I mean, it was a fantastic firework display, for want of a better word, and a lot of noise and gunfire going on, and you know, everybody's on edge. And you know, I think we did have shells, that were quite a few shells land within the company area, but that then passed over. And then we hear the next day that the Chinese had took 217 and 317. Well, the rumour goes on then. Right, the rumour goes on that we're going to have to do a counterattack. This is only rumour, mind you. I don't think this has ever been fact. The rumour were Norfolk's going to do the counterattack. But that was a rumour, because the counterattack were done by the Royal Leicesters. And they made valiant attempt to take it back. But you see, once you've got an high peak like that, with manpower that Chinamen have got, there were no way you were going to shift them, you know. And so that the Leicesters lost quite a few men and casualties in trying to take that back. Then the next night, it was, I suppose, again, it may not have been a stand two all night. I'm not quite sure. It may have been four on, two off sort of business. So you're on stag, or it could have been two on, four off. You know, in other words, it was somebody was on all the while in these weapon pits. Another interesting feature on that, raining about that sort of period, in those day or twos, telephone line had got cut by shell fire. I think it was the main line to battalion. So me and the other signaller, we went out to find the break in the line. So we went through the wire, you know, we knew where we could roll the wire back and get gaps in the wire. We went through the wire and we're trying to trace the wire back. You just trace it back until you come to the break, you see. Anyway, unbeknown to us, somebody, I should imagine, one of the artillery spotters, had called in airstrike onto the Chinese, who now occupied 317, 217 and that range of hills. Anyway, me and Danny, the other signaller, were busy out on this hillside off the company position, tracking this telephone line to find the break. And these Sabre jets come zooming in. And we'd had them zooming, so we used to just watch them and marvel at them, you know, when they were striking the Chinamen. Anyway, these come zooming in, and as they come over this hill, Danny and I, they start opening up with a cannon. So me and Danny hit the ground, you know, double fast, and it was bang, 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 you know. We didn't get it, but it was strafing the hill we were on. And they carried on, missed air hill. They, you know, carried on, peeled off from air hill, and they napalmed, I'm pretty sure it was D Company of Air Battalion, you see. Danny and I thought, crikey, we better try and get back to signal platoon and get, you know, get back through to battalion headquarters and get this stopped. But it was only that one pass. I think there were about, I think we had four or five planes in this sweep, you know, and they just come in, opened up, and they zoom round.
Are these Sabres British or American?
American Sabres, yeah, F-86, marvellous plane. And we've got a recognition panel on top of the dugout, the signal dugout. They're on the reverse side of the hill, and the recognition panels are fluorescent panels, about 6 foot long. I think one's a berry pink, and I think the other either green or a yellowy green. And what happens every day, you get a coordinate to put your recognition panels on. The signal that gets the coordinate, you know, from north to south with the green, and perhaps from east to west, you know, with a green, with a pink or whatever. So the panels were on there, but nevertheless, coming in at 600 mile an hour, one hilltop looks like another. Anyway, we scampered up the hill, and when we got there, we had a bit of a disturbing sight, because one of our sergeants, who was a Second World War veteran with numerous medals up, I can't honestly think of his name, but Minnie knows his name, he was in hell of a state. He really got what we'll call shell shock. We'd never seen anything like it. See, we old boys, we'd never seen warfare before, and we were 19, and he were really gone to pieces. He really were. And sadly, he were took away and never seen again. I mean, so I'm glad I don't know his name, but because he most likely got over it. But who's to say what he went through in the Second World War, you know, to trigger that? You know, so that was a bit of an unnerving thing. We think, here we are, what we just arrived. We'd only been in the country about a blooming month. And anyway, so that was that incident. And as I say, I think D Company got napalmed, but then they peeled off, and the spotter evidently up there with them must have corrected them, and they went on the Chinese targets where they're supposed to have went. But that was that battle when Speakman got his VC, and we were only on the periphery of it. But it was an open experience to warfare, really, from our point of view. We were there for a little longer. I don't know how much longer, really. Perhaps a few more weeks.
I think, yeah, it seems to have been sort of mid-November you pulled back.
It could be mid-November we pulled back, yeah. But then something that perhaps not in the records there, not happened, but transpired. C Company then was attached to Princess Pat Canadian Light Infantry. I don't think any other company were. So we go round from one side of 355 to the other, and Major Holden said we're being attached to Princess Pat's Canadian Light Infantry. So you know, establish your net. So I again get the old 31 set up. We try to get contact. Can't make it out. We're getting people jabbering away. So I said, I can understand it, Major Holden. I said, we've got the right channel. I said, we're getting foreigners. He said, how do you mean? I said, well, we ain't getting no English spoken. Ah, he said, you've got the Vandoos. So the Vandoos, you see, unbeknown to us, the Vandoos were the French-Canadian speaking Canadian regiment. You say, what had happened? We got the Vandoos on the net. But so that sorted itself out. We then got onto the Princess Pats. We were there then perhaps for a week or two. We had to dig a hole from scratch on this one. It was on a different side, on the other side of 355, and this was on a wooded slope, and we had to dig this hole there. We dug it about 2 foot wide, I suppose, about 8 foot long. I will show you a photograph of it in that room before you go, but anyway, and the other signal and I, we got all our kit festooned all round it, so this basically was a trench with no roof on. And we got this, and the thing what worried us there, being a wooded hillside, we got all these trees, and we were getting airbursts. If shells come along and hit the blessed trees, we were getting airbursts, and they were frightening things, because the shrapnel comes down. So if you are in a hole in the ground, and it did happen to plonk one of the trees near you, you could get caught with it. But that's that, you know, that didn't happen. So anyway, we were with the Princess Pats for a little while.
Anything happened while you were there?
No, nothing dramatic happened there. No, I can't think of anything dramatic. We were, you see, we were in the volatile position because the Chinese then took 317, and the thought were, if they take 355, we are at it. We've got to go back double quick, you know. But they didn't. I think they had one or two goes at it, but they were fought off by whoever was on it at that time, I suppose the KSLI, and on our side, the Canadians, you know. So no, they didn't knock us off that at all. In fact, I said a few years after the war, I was talking. I said 355 was never lost while I was out there. But I've been proved wrong on that. The Americans took it over sometime in 51, and I think they lost it for a night and took it back the next day. So, but anyway, on that period, no, we didn't lose 355. We were with the Canadians a little spell, and from there on, we come off the Canadians, and then we were going around the San Michan Valley, which is quite away from 355, in viewing distance, but different sort of area altogether. I don't quite know who we took over from in the San Michan, but we moved around to the San Michan Valley position, which we occupied then, I suppose, through till springtime of 52. Similar situation, dugouts.
Now, can you talk a bit about the terrain? We haven't really talked about the terrain.
No.
Tell us what the terrain was like generally in the whole area and in the summer.
Well, very mountainous. We wouldn't say mountainous like you would say the Highlands of Scotland are mountainous, but very mountainous. Everything's a hill. So all positions were on hilltops. You know, you wouldn't have your position in the valley. On the hilltops, you've got a commanding view, and also you can circle it with wire. You can do your communication trenches up there. But everything's going to be carried up, see? So in other words, your water and your fuel, you know, like for your cooking or whatever, is all got to be carried up the hill, and all your food is, and ammunition, everything. We used to use Korean porters.
How's about that then?
Well, Korean porters are civilians. They're hard-working men, and they used to carry the old A-frame, and they'd carry like a jerry can full of water or a box of ammunition. They were non-combatant. They'd come up and being the suppliers. So that you know, if you were in a static position on the hilltops, they'd carry this stuff up and bring your supplies up for you, which was a big help, you see. But as regards when you're moving positions, you carry your own stuff then, you know. But then we got, that was the, we moved around to the sandwich on position.
There's now, what were the positions like there? And this is where you started to build bigger dugouts. And
we did, yeah.
Fancier dugouts.
Well, they were bigger. Yeah, they were bigger because we really were getting, it's getting towards winter, and we were getting blimmin' cold because the old wind blows in from Siberia. And what we used to do there, and I think most battalions perhaps follow the same procedure, we must have learned it from somebody. This dugout, Danny and I, the other signals dugout, were perhaps about 6 foot square. Yeah, I will say 6 foot square, perhaps about 4 foot deep, with a covering of logs and sandbags on the top. Major Holden's dugout next to it was about 2 foot away from us, and we cut a little hole in the wall so we could hand the handset through. See, Major Holden was in there, so it was about a foot of sort of wall between us. So his was a very slimmer dugout. I think he might have had a camp bed because Major Holden had got a batman, you see. But I mean, he lived in rough conditions, same as we did. Anyway, the in there, it being as it coming on for winter, what we used to do, we got a shell case from the old Centurion tanks, 20 pounder. We got, you know, implements. We all had a digging implement, pickaxe or shovel. So we knocked some holes into it. We stood it up at the top of one corner of the dugout. On top of that, we'd get the case, what the 20 pounder come in, which was a bit bigger diameter. So that'd fit over the top. And maybe another one over the top of that. So in other words, you've got the shell case sticking up about 2 foot 6 inch from the ground with all holes in. You've got two shell case, what the shells used to come in, I gather, which would fit over the top of that as a chimney, sticking out the top of your dugout. So it just protruded. Because bear in mind, we were all on the reverse side of the hill, these dugouts. Then you'll get a bit of aerial, and somebody used a strange rubber pipe from somewhere, but you'll get a bit of radio aerial. You tap the end, so there was only a little wee hole in it. You get a bit of rubber pipe on the end, and you'd have a 5 gallon jerry can full of Ioptime petrol from the old, what I used to run the old Centurion, the Yankee tanks on. You'd suck that in until it just started to drip out the end of this bit of air. Then you'd stick it in the shell case with the holes in at the bottom and light it. Course that used to get blooming red hot, and you God dear, them dugouts really used to get warm, and this used to keep the dugouts warmed up nice. But the trouble were, we weren't very clean. I mean, we at that time we had winter clothes issued, right? The jungle greens had gone away, and we'd had winter clothes. Now our winter kit was blooming good.
What was it?
Winter kit were good, right? What was it? I try and remember. There were pants, long pants, long johns, with a split front and rear, and a vest to match, with long sleeves, you know, like the old cowboys did. On top of that, you'd have a string vest. Then you'd have your ordinary khaki shirt, the army khaki flannel shirt. You'd have a lovely thick woolen pullover. Then you'd have a combat jacket, which was a multi-layered gabardine, it was olive green, and you'd have combat trousers made of the same material, kind of multi-layered. I think there'd be three or four layers of gabardine, so it all sewn, so if you tore one, you'd ink it through to your bare knee. Boots, you had good old boots made in this area by John White, which would please me, because he's in the insole, I could see, made John White. So that was good, having home boots made in your own town. And they were the old commando soles, not the old, we never did have the leather sole with the studs in Korea. We had the old commando cleated soles. You get thick socks. There'd be a pair of pants that were made of like the stuff fleece jackets are made of today. They really were. You have a parka, which were good, which was an overcoat to go over your combat jacket, which was again gabardine with a hood that come up with fur. And if I remember, yeah, and then I got the same sort of material as modern fleece jackets, as lining for this parka. and it had got a wire. The hood was wired, so you could shape your hood, so you only got a little hole for your face. You had got gloves that come up your arm, white gloves. You got a snowsuit, trousers, and a top to go over them if it warranted it.
Snowsuit.
Yes, no, a pair of white trousers and a white cagoule, we'll call it. So you were actually covered in white, you know, in for any snow. And that would be the equipment. That were good. But just going back to saying we were dirty, well, the shirt I wore, they were the same flannel shirts we had in the UK, the old army khaki flannel shirts. And mine had been washed by Grandma before I went out to Korea. When I went back to join the battalion to get on the Orwell, when we were out in the jungle greens, that was packed away. Now, that shirt I was wearing from when we ever got when we went from jungle greens to winter kit, which must have been about November, I was wearing that shirt, I think, well up past Christmas, because there were no facilities and we were lousy with lice. We couldn't make it out. We were itching, and somebody said your pats got lice. Crikey. So you get your shirt off, and in the seams of your shirt you could see these lice and all the little lice eggs. So anyway, one night it was so bad when we got this fire going, it was so bad that I actually went outside and I stripped off and rubbed snow on me. I mean, they were itching so bad. In a very dirty condition. I don't think any of us hadn't got lice.
Was there anything you could do about that?
Well, yeah, they give us some AL67, I think it was called, and it was like anti-lice powder. So once it would get established, they give us this lice powder, and I think it killed the lice, but not the eggs. So you had to do it quite regularly, you know. But we had noticed when we were going up on the train that we used to see these Korean peasants sitting outside the little storehouses going up the seams. You know, we never knew what they were doing. They were going up the seams cracking lice. You know, as we were going up on the train, we could see them doing that. And that must have been a natural thing they did. You know, I mean, they ain't got bath edges like we used to. Anyway, that's how we used to live in this dugout. It got very warm, as I say, and...
Did you make beds in the dugout there?
Yeah, we did. After being there a little while, we got telephone wire and small pickets, the old small pickets. The old Americans done us the favour with them. We knocked them into the ground and we put two long ones on, and then we threaded telephone assault cable backwards and forwards to make a bit of a mattress. And, we had two beds, one each, me and Dan and the other signaller. And that's how we lived in that dugout. Yes, it is. Yeah.
Now, what about your food? Tell me about the food. You've told me a bit about the American rations, but what food were you getting in the Samichon?
Well, in the Samichon, we had our own cook. Just behind the reverse side for the eel, they put a bit of a tent up. I suppose it was like something like these. I think it was a tent, and then at the front, something like these. Gazebo things you buy now with four poles each corner, a bit of a roof. Anyway, we had a cook. He was catering corps cook. His name was Dear Love. He looked to be washed when he left the UK, and he hadn't bothered since, you know, because you're over these cookers all the while, you know, they shoot the hot flame out. Anyway, he used to cook whatever rations he could get. He'd cook them on this field kitchen thing, and we'd all go down there, and he'd dollop the thing out, or somebody would help him dollop the thing out, yeah.
What was it like? What was the food like you got? What was it, basically?
Well, it was, I suppose it was all reconstituted potatoes and cabbage, their eggs and bacon. And I think quite often we were on American ration, and they'd bring some like thermos things down, and it were chicken in there, all broke up. So, you know, it was okay. And for breakfast, I think you'll get egg and perhaps you get tin bacon. That tin bacon was nice. It was rolled, if I remember right. And we lived all right like that. Yes, we did.